All right, so I mean, I know you guys have heard the problems of particle physics from Veronica, those of you who are in Veronica's class, probably from Michael as well. So I don't want to spend too much time on it, but at the same time, those are the problems that motivate all of the, so those are the problems that motivate all the experiments that are going on right now, that motivate theorists in trying to understand what's coming out of those experiments. And so I just want to give you guys a brief refresher on sort of the status of the standard model as of 2011 and the status of the experimental probes. So of course, you all know that all of these mesons and baryons that we worked out, the decays of and whatnot, can be described by an extremely simple Lagrangian with this gauge symmetry. So all the particles are charged under it. The gauge Lagrangian is simple. It's just specified by the quantum numbers of each of the particles. So we have leptons. We have I'm talking about these just in terms of the left-hand. By the way, did you guys learn how to do calculations with two-component spinners, two-component fermions? Yes? Great. Okay. Good. Oh, thank you. Yeah, that was smart of him. There's the electron, there's the quarks, ups, the downs, you know, all their charges. We think there's something like a Higgs, putting it in quotes because we haven't seen it. We don't know directly that it really behaves like a fundamental particle, but there has to be something that gives the weak mesons their mass. And so that's the first, I think one of the first questions that we hope to answer is just what's the dynamics of the SU2 cross U1 to U1 breaking? Is it something like a Higgs that really behaves as a fundamental particle or not? And if it is fundamental, by fundamental I mean that it behaves like a point-like particle up to some scale, lambda, that's much larger than its mass. So of course, I mean, when I say fundamental, it's natural to think, well, yeah, sorry. Sorry, which brackets? Oh, just 2-1 minus a half, just the, so this is the standard way of writing charges, right? The SU2, what multiplet of SU2 it's in, what multiplet of SU3, and then a hypercharge. So I was using here the convention that electromagnetic charge is equal to T3 plus Y. And this is that Y. Sometimes people use Y over 2 and just double these charges. And so in the same notation, the Q would be a 2, 3 plus a sixth, and so on. So as I was saying, this fundamental word, people think, well, of course, you know, isn't it a huge leap to say that the Higgs is really fundamental? All we're really asking when people talk about a fundamental Higgs is, does it behave as point-like over some range of energies? Does it scatter the way an electron would? That if you, for any energy less than this cutoff lambda, cross-sections for the Higgs would go like 1 over E squared. That's what a point-like particle does. And I'll actually come back to the difference between electron and proton scattering, which should make this a little more clear. In that case, if it behaves as well described by sort of point-like interactions up to some scale, then whatever new physics is at that scale can lead to quantum corrections to its mass. And so one would naively expect then that the Higgs mass squared is of order lambda squared, and that the W mass squared is of order G squared times lambda squared. Well, so this is clearly at odds with this, right? So then there's this this question, why is it light? Certainly a lot of the theories that have been developed over the last 20 years have really been motivated by trying to provide excellent answers to this question, things like supersymmetry, extra dimensions, technicolor. Okay, moving away from this picture, one of the other cliche pictures of particle physics, which Philip already drew and everybody else does too, is this one, right? What is the dark matter? And why is the cosmological constant small? And perhaps not equal to zero. I'm asking the question this way because we don't know what this dark energy actually is, but we know one reasonable thing that would behave like dark energy is just a constant term in the Lagrangian coupled to gravity. And so that, just like this argument, that constant term has a mass dimension, has mass dimension 4. So if you have some, we usually call the cosmological constant and the cutoff lambda, so that's the problem. The expectation is that lambda cc should be of order, which has dimension 4, should be of order lambda cutoff to the 4th. I mean, this is a really confusing equation because we both call them lambda. All I'm saying is that the vacuum energy density should be of order the cutoff to the 4th. So why is it small? And is that actually the thing making up this big chunk of the pie or not? These two, as I mentioned, are closely related. They're both questions of why is there a mass parameter in your theory? Why is there a big separation in mass parameters of the theory when quantum mechanics, as we understand it, drives mass parameters large by virtue of other couplings of the particles? Similar question, but actually very different, has to do with the Yukawas. So if we take this Higgs field, whether it's got some constituents or not, and we write down our Yukawa couplings, which are responsible for the masses of the quarks and leptons, some y down, y up, and y for the leptons. Sorry. These Yukawa couplings are the only thing in the theory that break. So if you just had the gauge interactions, you would have a U3 to the 5th flavor symmetry, which is to say that all 5 of these kinds of particles that have 3 generations that behave the same way, except for the Yukawa couplings. That's been tested to pretty good precision, that there isn't a whole lot of new structure. One could certainly write down effective operators that involve higher powers, right? So one could write down, for example, a QD H LH. This isn't the simplest one. This is just the one I'm remembering off the top of the one that I can write down easily. Suppressed by some high mass scale. Sorry, this isn't even satisfied fermion number. Okay. I won't do this in real time, but one can certainly have higher power interactions of the same fields. I mean, you can just write down something chiral like this. QD mod squared, right? So you can track these two together, et cetera. There's all these interactions that one can write down, suppressed by mass to some power. These are small. Okay? So there's two puzzles about flavor. One is that if you just look at these Yukawas, they range from the smallest one, around 10 to the minus 6 for the electron, to 1 for the top quark. So these are just pure numbers in the Lagrangian that cover a wide range. Nobody knows why. One might try to explain the origin of that structure. Why there's no other flavor structure. In other words, if these terms here appear at all, they have to appear with some very high mass scale suppressing them. And then also in the neutrino sector. I mentioned this is the smallest Yukawa. That's because we don't know that the neutrino mass comes from a Yukawa. There could be some Yukawa coupling to a right-handed neutrino. It's called a Dirac neutrino mass. You could also have this here is a gauge singlet. One could just have some, you know, AIJ here. These are the flavor indices. That would be a Majorana mass for the neutrino. When you put both Higgs to the VeV, mass of order the Higgs VeV squared over this big M. Then the A's don't have to be so small. So the smallness of neutrino masses means one of two things. Either there's a very small Yukawa coupling in town, or there's a new scale that's actually a much higher mass scale associated with neutrino masses. Yeah. Sorry. Okay. So I'm just using. So H is my Higgs field. It's a scalar. I've suppressed all the indices, so that's probably why it's confusing. Q here is the fermion field. So if I wanted to expand this out more explicitly, I could give these psi Qs. So this is a fermion. It has a spin index. And in the case of a Q, it also has a flavor index because there's three generations. And it also has its SU2 index and SU3 index. So basically, I would now contract that. Let's call this A and B. This is going to be the strong. This runs from 1 to 3. Use N for the weaks. Runs from 1 to 2. Well, then one contracts that with the Higgs scalar field, which has just an N index, just has an SU2 index, and the up quark field, which has now just a 3-bar index, and also a spin index. So, I mean, that's a lot of it. It's a lot of indices, and they're contracted sort of the only way they can be. So that's why people don't write them down a lot of the time. But does that make a little more sense? So all of these that I'm writing down, the Qs, Ds, Ls, and Es are fermions. Hs are just the Higgs scalars. Yeah. No, not in general, and in fact, not in the standard model, right? So if you look at it's actually, so you can diagonalize either one of them, and then the other one will be left with some off-diagonal terms. And that's what gives rise to the CKM matrix.
Do you really want to have a dimensional coupling up from the LH?
Yes, because if you count the mass dimensions of these fields, why? Well, so here I wrote a big, if this mass is very big, There's nothing wrong with this term. It's part of, as in a part of your effective theory, there's absolutely nothing wrong with it. We write down mass terms all the time, right? So it's true, this is called a non-renormalizable coupling. What that means, but it's really not a very scary thing. Let's say you took this term, this kind of Dirac mass, but imagine that that N is some really heavy field. Then when you integrate it out of the theory, right? I mean, if you have, you're just completing the square, but completing the square between things that now involve two fields. So you'll get precisely a term like this. So I'm imagining that I have some high-scale Lagrangian that looks like LHN with a Yukawa coupling plus some right-handed neutrino mass. It's like this. This is a completely neutral term, so I can write this down. And then plus kinetic terms. And when I integrate out the N, I can write this as, you know, YLH plus MN N squared minus times 1 over MN. Right? That's just completing the square. I need to subtract off a term, a 1 over MN times Y squared LH squared. When I integrate out the N, I just effectively get rid of this term and I'm left with this. So it's totally reasonable to see these, to have these couplings. But if the scale that's in the denominator is large, they're hard to see. In fact, there's one dimensionful coupling that we write down all the time, which is gravity. Right? It has a 1 over M Planck squared in the Einstein Lagrangian. And we see it all the time just because we're talking about total, because it acts coherently on matter, right? It acts universally. And the total masses that we interact with are actually much bigger than 1 over m squared. For fundamental particles, that's never true. So that's why gravity is so suppressed. But the energy is much less than the mass, than the Planck mass. But we deal with these all the time. And they're certainly a very useful way of organizing your thinking about interactions that aren't, that, you know, that are generated at a scale that's very large, much larger than the scales you're probing. So like the Fermi theory is another example. Before the discovery of the W and the Z, before people really understood that, all we knew was this interaction, G Fermi times, psi gamma mu 1 plus gamma 5 psi bar, you know, times another guy of the same form. And if you count again, this is 4 spin 1 half guys. Each one has mass dimension 3 halves. So G Fermi must have mass dimension minus 2. And we know where this comes from. It comes from the W and the Z. In the case of the charge currents, it comes from integrating out the W boson, which was a very reasonable thing to do before one could actually produce the W boson in colliders and understand its structure. Then, so the goal with these, anytime you see one of these, it is a hint that there's some physics at a new scale that you want to understand directly. You want to be able to unwrap these. But there's more than one way to unwrap a given operator. And one needs to uncover a lot about the structure of the theory at low energies in order to guess that. Or you need to build a really big collider to get there. All right. So where was I? Flavor, and then speaking of higher dimension operators, gravity, how does it fit in? And then another one that I won't spend too much time on is that, but I think is a major problem as well, is that in the strong interactions, respect a CP symmetry. We know the weak interactions don't. In fact, they violate it pretty badly in the Yukawa matrix. As we understand field theory, there is no reason that the strong interaction should respect the symmetry. It's easy to write down the terms and just basically complexifying, thinking of the gauge coupling as complex. You would expect to see some violation of this, of CP in strong interactions. And for example, in the electric dipole moment of the neutron, hasn't been seen. So in fact, it's about 10 orders of magnitude smaller than you would expect. So presumably, again, this makes you think that there's some dynamics responsible for this, but we only see it indirectly. So all of these questions that I've listed, with the exception of gravity, are sort of structural problems. We understand this theory really well. People have done 5 loop calculations to predict radiative corrections to different processes. Calculations of electromagnetic effects in field theory agree to 12 decimal places with observations. You know, this isn't a bad theory. It works extremely precisely. But it has these sort of structural features that beg for an explanation. And so even though we have a perfectly consistent theory, trying to understand and get any hints for what what plays each of these roles, what makes each of these features happen, is a major ongoing effort. So in particular, I guess this is largely a theoretical cosmological question and cosmological observation question. Dark matter certainly has some astronomical cosmological observation elements to it that are very important. But if I had to focus on the sort of particle physics experiments, there's really 4 types. Sorry, maybe more than 4. So there's high energy colliders. And these are really trying to directly explore the scales that we know there should be some new physics at. So SU2 is broken. It should be broken by a Higgs. I erased it already. But basically, you expect that. But we know that the Higgs dynamics has to be just around the corner from the weak scale, separated by the coupling G of SU2. Could be G higher, but shouldn't be much more. So we've produced W's and Z's and accelerators. We've produced, how many at LEP? Well, I'll get to it. We've produced millions of them. So these are trying to look at the Higgs sector. What, if anything, stabilizes the Higgs sector? And there's certainly a hope of also understanding something about dark matter. If you produce it at the collider, that's no guarantee. These are most directly trying to study the symmetry breaking sector and really understand the dynamics of the breaking of this SU2 very well and any possible mysteries associated with it. Why is the Higgs light? There's also a whole lot of colliders at lower energy but high luminosity. So these really dynamics of the weak scale. There's colliders at high luminosity and also fixed target other experiments, basically trying to get really high statistics for flavor. And we're going to spend a lot of time talking about these in this course. I'm hoping we'll also have a little bit of time to talk about this flavor physics. I'm not sure. There's dark matter detection. there's a whole lot of new experiments coming online now. Yeah. Oh, come on, I have a microphone on. I'm not going to insult the other ones. Right now, I think there's one dark matter experiment that is likely to release important results within the next month or two, which is Xenon 100. And if they see anything or any hint of anything, then they are certainly, then there is a whole slew of other experiments that will be absolutely crucial to understanding it. If they don't, there's a smaller set of experiments that'll have either complementary reach or the capacity to eventually outpace it, but are a little further along. It's also worth mentioning that, you know, dark matter has already been detected according to the claims of some experiments. So that may be, maybe it's already been seen, but there's certainly some tension in trying to reconcile that with the observations of other experiments. In general, the Xenon 100 results should be very exciting. I think there's a seminar about it scheduled at PI, which keeps getting postponed because they take a while to look into their data set. There is a lot of activity going on in this field right now, and it certainly could be very exciting over the next couple of years. There's also neutrino experiments, which probe... two other things I didn't mention, having to do with just these gauge forces. So another cliche plot, right? They unify. Is it a coincidence? And also, is there other stuff? Sorry, I know I'm running out of space. Is there other stuff that's not charged under this? Maybe it's charged under some other forces that this stuff isn't charged under. That's a really broad question, but just like seeing the first mesons that carried strangeness were a big surprise. That's why they called it that. and trying to make sense of them ended up leading to this whole picture our modern picture of the standard model. So seeing anything that wasn't charged under these symmetries but had some new interactions instead, that would be a really big deal. But it's less clear exactly how to go about that. You kind of have to be lucky. The neutrino experiments are one way to do that. And they're also trying to answer these questions about what is the structure of the neutrino mass matrix? And is it the same kind of structure as these Yukawas, or is it really telling us about physics at a higher scale? In particular, there's two classes of these basically oscillation experiments, which are just measuring the mass matrix, the masses themselves, mass differences between different flavors, and neutrinoless double beta decay, experiments, which are really trying to study if the mass of the neutrino is coming from something like this, then the neutrino is its own antiparticle, which means that physical processes that emit two neutrinos could also emit zero neutrinos, right? You don't only have a neutrino parity, not some conserved neutrino number. So these are experiments looking for processes with no neutrinos, which would tell you about the mass of the neutrino, where it's the fact that it really comes from an interaction of this form. So most of this class, like I said, will focus on this. That and dark matter detection are certainly the things that I spend the most of my time thinking about. I know the most about. I do hope we'll be able to touch on these other three as well. So let me just give you now a brief survey of what the world's collider scene looks like. Trying to erase this standard model and replace it with a new one. is their goal, so it's appropriate that I just cleared that. So there was an E plus E minus collider called LEP. It ran from 1989 to 2000. At CERN, and they ran, like I said, they produced a ton of Zs. So they ran in an E plus E minus machine, right? You can produce a Z really efficiently when the total center mass energy of the collider is the Z mass. So they ran, and they could actually study the shape of the Z peak. Do all kinds of precision measurements by just hovering their center mass energy around the mass of the Z. So they collected, they produced 20 million Zs, which corresponds to a luminosity of 60 inverse picobarns. So that means that if you had a process, some scattering process with a cross section of a picobarn, which is 10 to the minus 12 barns, which is 10 to the minus 36 centimeters squared, you would have produced 60 of them. Now, one can convert that to natural units. 10 to the minus 36 centimeters squared over 2 10 to the minus 14 GeV centimeters squared, you see that that's 10 to the minus 8 Jev to the minus 2. Did I do my math right? I think so. Quarter. So that means that if you had a, of course, these guys usually, they're electrons, so you would have expected to have a, let me back up. This is only half of it. They also ran at about 200 GeV, center of mass energy. 209 was their highest. Almost 10 times as much data, 500 inverse picobarns. This was really precision for precision measurements of the Z, trying to understand electroweak symmetry breaking very well. And it's one of the reasons that we think that the Higgs is fundamental. Has to do. Did Michael talk about precision electroweak measurements at all? Those words come up. Okay, I'll try to talk about them later. He played a really important role in developing the theory for this, but for very precise measurements of the physics at the Z peak, in order to understand the structure of electroweak symmetry breaking, and this is one of the things that makes us think that the Higgs is fundamental. This higher energy run was really designed to try to look for new particles that would be produced in these collisions. So the important thing, well, I'll leave it at that for now. Now the so again, this was say 500 inverse picobarns at 200 GeV plus 20 million Zs. There's also currently running, but probably soon to shut down, at Fermilab in Illinois, the Tevatron, which is running at roughly 10 times the energy, 2 TeV. It's a PP bar machine. And they have collected about 10 inverse femtobarns of data to date. They've only, depending on the different analyses, haven't used this whole amount. That's what's been delivered by the accelerator so far. Now, comparing luminosities at lepton and hadron colliders is really like apples and oranges. But this is also an extremely significant amount of data. The LHC just started running, accumulated a lot of data in 2010. So they have collected, so they're running at 7 TeV. The design was 14, and there are plans to go to something close, maybe not all the way, but you know, up to 10 or something several years down the road. In 2010, they collected about 50, well, let me say 40, inverse picomorns at this much higher energy, so a lot less data than the Tevatron. But at higher energy, I'll tell you about how to compare these probably tomorrow. It's getting late. And the also in 2011, probably one to a few inverse femtobarns. So again, much less integrated luminosity, but at a higher energy, which is letting you probe new regions. Okay, there's other high energy colliders. I should say the Tevatron has, there were four experiments at LEP, all pretty much looking for the same kinds of things in these collisions. Tevatron, there are two experiments named CDF and D0. Again, both multipurpose collider experiments trying to measure cross sections for different standard model processes and search for new particle production. At the LHC, there are four main experiments. Two of them are like these multipurpose experiments, ATLAS and CMS. There's also, I should also say that all of these experiments, these so-called multipurpose ones, are also complementary to these high luminosity colliders for studying flavor physics. In particular, one can make very nice observations of B mesons at these experiments. There's actually a dedicated experiment at the LHC for looking at these. It's called LHCB. And then there's a heavy ion experiment called ALICE. These flavor colliders are actually kind of cool. They run at around 10 GeV. In particular, I'll focus on the B factories. They run at a center of mass energy of about 10 TeV, really the mass of upsilon mesons, high excited. So these upsilons are BB bar mesons. If you produce an excited state, for example, the upsilon 4s, then it'll actually decay to these capital B mesons, which have one bottom quark and one lighter quark. So for example, normal Bs are just a bottom quark and a D bar. There's also B sub S's, which also have a strange quark. These let you study flavor transitions very precisely. And one of the kind of neat things about these colliders is that they're actually running in an asymmetric configuration. So they have a high energy electron beam, lower energy positron beam. What that means is that when you produce a BB bar pair, produce an upsilon, the upsilon travels this way. It decays, still traveling this way. So that lets them measure the decay properties very precisely. C tau for these B mesons is actually about a half a millimeter. You don't really need to know about this. I just think it's kind of cool. Sorry to ramble about it. All right. So, until recently, in these B factories, until recently, there was Babar at SLAC. And there's Bell, which I believe is in Japan, but I'm actually not positive where it is. And there's plans for something called the Super B factory, which will probably, there's an Italian group looking at this, and then there's also upgrades for Bell being planned. So Babar is no more. Bell, I think, is still running. Okay, so now back to what we're really going to focus on. We'll talk a little bit about LEP later on, but the main thing that we're going to focus on in at least the next week or so is these guys. These are obviously the highest energy processes that one can produce in the lab. So we really want to understand what one can do with these proton-proton collisions, what they look like, and how you search for new physics in them. That's going to be a major theme of the rest of this class. So to start with that, there is a little bit of sort of nitty-gritty stuff that one has to do just to get familiar with what actually happens when protons interact. So, I mean, calculating E plus E minus interaction cross sections, it's a lot of work. If there's gauge interactions involved, you have to contract a bunch of tensor indices and all that stuff. But it's sort of a straightforward perturbation theory exercise. You know what the rules are for that. Protons are a little bit different. So if we think about, for example, at the LHC, center of mass energy of 7 TeV, well, you know that the typical cross sections that you'd expect just by dimensional analysis at 7 TeV are 1 over 7 TeV squared, right? Maybe with some alphas. Very schematically. Another way of saying this is that when you have that the typical length scale associated with the size probed by these by 7 TeV particle can be as low to as 1 over E, which in this case, let me just call it 10 to the 4 JeV. And again, you put in your 10 to the minus 14 JeV centimeters. This is about 10 to the minus 18 centimeters, or 10 to the minus 5 Fermi. In contrast to this, the proton is a really big object. Its size is about 1 Fermi, or 1 over 0.2 GeV. This 0.2 GeV is just the scale of strong coupling QCD. So that means that these proton-proton interactions really depend upon the structure of the proton. So the structure of the proton is not 7 TeV scale physics. It's mostly around 1 GeV scale physics. But it plays a really important role in how those collisions develop. So I think today I will try to do the simpler case of just talk a little bit conceptually about what happens in proton-electron scattering. I should say all of these, I mean, there's all these sort of quote-unquote intuitive ways of understanding the processes I'm about to tell you about. I don't think they're very clear. I don't think they're very intuitive. But it's still better than nothing, so I'm going to do it too. But if this doesn't seem totally clear and logical to you, it might be my fault. It's certainly not your fault. This is sort of trying to make intuitive something that's actually a little subtle. And as I said, this is the basic issue, right? So if you think about what does a proton look like, suppose you had a one of a microscope, so you can blow up that one Fermi size. Well, a simple example of such a microscope is to just take an electron at high energies, bang that off a proton, right? That's a lot simpler. Roughly what you're looking for is you have your proton at rest, and then there's going to be some photon, right? Proton's charge, it has charged constituents, some photon that can interact with the proton, might send it flying, might also emit a couple of pions. Who knows what happens over here? The microscope is that you can watch what happens to the electron. If the electron comes in with some energy E, goes out with some energy E prime and at an angle theta, then you can deduce from that, by momentum conservation, what the momentum Q carried by that photon was. See, what does the proton look like to a photon of momentum Q? So now I will imagine that you can just blow up a proton to a visible size. You know that it's a bound state of three quarks, two up quarks and a down quark. It's a bound state. In fact, these things have all kinds of, you know, they're strongly interacting. They're talking to each other all the time, exchanging gluons, gluons that connect to their own lines, gluons that split into other quarks. There's a lot of action going on inside the proton at these when you blow it up to these small scales. Just like, I mean, even a hydrogen atom, if you were to blow it up, there's, you could think of all of the force mediated between them as just a bunch of, as the fact that there's constantly some virtual photons scattering in there. In the case of a proton, have all these gluons connecting the quark lines, and now you can ask, in this picture, what does hitting it with a high-energy photon do? Well, one thing that photon can do is it can hit. Remember, the frequency of this photon is much, much higher than a Fermi. So it's really going to see all these constituents. So it can interact with one of the quarks, send it off flying. Could also have interacted with this guy. Could actually break the loop. You can write down diagrams like this. And then that would give this guy a big kick, and some dynamics something would have to happen to this guy as well. But if you look at the energy scales involved, most of these interactions, if you ask what kind of momentum is exchanged, what kind of invariant mass do these intermediate states have, it's mostly momenta of order, this lambda QCD. Sort of Jeff scale physics. You're hitting it with some Q that's much larger than a GeV. And so the point is, this interaction happens over a very short period of time compared to the natural time scale for everything else that's happening in the proton. This interaction happens over a time scale 1 over Q. Everything else is happening at a time scale more or less of order 1 over lambda QCD. And so that means that the response to the photon is dominantly controlled by whichever object it hit, not by the rest of the proton. The rest of the proton can't coherently respond to this photon. Now, let's try to, so effectively this looks like some free quark. It still interacts, but you can treat it in perturbation theory. That's the rough intuition behind what's called the parton model. You can look at it also in the rest frame of the electron. Imagine that you're an electron. There's some big proton barreling towards you. I've drawn it like this because it's boosted, right? So that means because of the boost, there's a Lorentz contraction. The proton just looks like a big, big flat pancake to this electron right here. Also, there's time dilation. So that means that in this frame, all of these QCD processes that I was talking about really take place slowly, right? It's not just a time scale of 1 over lambda QCD. It's dilated by your boost gamma. So as far as this electron cares, if it's going to have a high energy interaction with this proton, all it cares about is this sort of is a time slice through this process. Right, so some time slices some instantaneous time slices, you would slice through the gluons. Sometimes you don't. And depending on when you slice, each of these constituents would be carrying a different fraction of the energy. So this is all to motivate that, and again, I don't know if it's really a clear, convincing motivation or not, but this is a formula that's been experimentally established that the cross-section for scattering an electron off a proton to produce, for a particular, this E prime means a particular kinematics of the electron after scattering, and we're not going to worry too much about what happened to the proton. At high energies, it'll split up into a bunch of crap. Sometimes it'll produce KK bar pairs. Sometimes it'll produce pions. Sometimes, it can produce all the particles we know and love. But if you ask very inclusive questions about this, right? Just d sigma, d, basically this d momentum of the E prime of the scattered electron. Those questions, you can write this cross section as being equal to a sum over all the different types of quark and anti-quark I times an integral I'll explain the components of this in a minute d sigma So you can write it in terms of interaction with just a single quark. That's motivated by the picture I was telling you, that this happens over a very short time scale, and if you're going to have, and over very short distances, so if you just restrict your attention to events where the electron gets scattered by a large amount, the reason it was getting scattered by a large amount is because effectively it had a very small impact parameter. If you want to think about it classically, it had a very small impact parameter with one of the quark wave functions, and then it's scattered, and its scattering is dominated by that quark. Okay? So there's a differential cross-section for just scattering off a single quark or an anti-quark. This would actually include I equals quarks and anti-quarks. And gluons, except in this example I'm talking about an electron, it doesn't couple to gluons. But if I had some way of probing the proton with a free quark, which doesn't make sense, then it would all, or with something that somehow coupled to gluons, then this sum would also include the gluons. So where the gluons and the antiquarks come from as all these sort of binding and pair creation processes that one should think of as happening inside of the proton. So this here is just a cross section for scattering off a quark. That's something you can calculate the same way you calculate E plus E minus scattering. This is what's called a parton density. Parton distribution function. And it means what it corresponds to roughly is the probability density for a probe like the photon, but it doesn't matter if it's a photon or something else, it's actually universal. For a probe at a scale Q. So in this case, that would be the spatial momentum of this photon. Probability density for a probe at scale Q to see a parton. Again, these I's, quarks, antiquarks, or gluons, they're all called partons. To see a parton that carries a fraction x of the proton energy. So does this roughly make sense? Do you guys have questions about it? Okay. Sure you don't have questions? All right, great. That means I did a very good job or a very bad job. So what's very useful about this is that this F is sort of, it's really about the structure. This is the structure of the proton. That it's parametrizing, that depends on QCD close to the size of the proton in the region where it's strongly coupled. So we don't know how to calculate this F from first principles. What we do know, so you take this F of XQ, you can measure the X dependence at fixed Q. For example, with electron-proton scattering, what I was just telling you about, because we have a pretty good theoretical understanding of how quarks interact with photons and also how electrons interact with photons. So we can, if we know this and we measure these differential cross sections, we can get a handle at a given Q on these X. For the Q dependence, this is actually calculable. It's calculable in, this is just perturbative QCD, and essentially what it has to do with is that if you think about a proton where one of these quark lines is undergoing splittings and rejoinings, as you go from one Q to, so let's say this is at some scale mu, if you look at F at scales Q less than mu, so this is Q less than mu, sorry, other way around, for high scales, for high momenta, that can probe what's happening on time scales less than 1 over mu, so it can actually look at the inside of these diagrams, whereas for Q less than mu, so for Q, sorry, what I'm saying is that for Q greater than mu, you would be sensitive to these two intermediate lines. For Q less than mu, one would be sensitive to just one would only see interactions of the sort of outside of this loop. And so by being able to calculate these rates in perturbative QCD, one can actually write down equations for df, write it as d log q, because it's logarithmic, it's logarithmically dependent on q, and these go like alpha over pi times some functions of x. This is alpha 3, so this is pretty strong process. And these are called the d-glap evolution equations. It's not important for you to understand the details of them, but it's important to know that they exist. That's what allows you to take F of one Q and evolve it to a different Q. And the dependence is logarithmic. So for example, and I think I'm going to almost end here, if one looks at what's called the valence PDFs. So this means you're keeping track of just the piece that comes from these quark lines, not the pieces that come from you know, the intermediate gluons or the quark loops. The valence part, for example, if you plot x times f up, valence as a function of x at different q's, so this goes from 0, from 10 to the 0 to 10 to the minus 4 in x, at 3jev, you might get something like this. So this is q equals 3jev. This is q equals 1TeV. And these differ by a factor of a few only. So over 2 and 2, so, and the other thing to remember, this is x times f, right? So actually, this distribution, if one were to just plot f, it would go like this. On a log scale, you're extremely unlikely to see a parton with the full energy x equals 1. And if you look at some typical, some high x, say 0.5, that's hundreds of times less likely, right? Because I need to multiply by x. That's hundreds of times less likely than seeing it with a low x. But as a function of q, it's changing by a factor of few. And then I'll probably go over more of this next time. But this shape is even more dramatic for these so-called C PDFs, the ones coming from the gluons and loops or the quarks and loops. Those actually vanish really fast, even when you look at x times f of x at fixed q. They go like this, and then if you were to plot just, and they change by, for example, this is like, even starting from 0.1 out to 10 to the minus 4, they're growing very dramatically. So x f of x changes by like 5 orders of magnitude. And if you were to just look at f of x between here, but at smaller x, it would be larger by 8 orders of magnitude, at 10 to the minus 4 compared to 0.1. So these are very rapidly varying functions of x. And most of the time, when you scatter something into a proton, you aren't actually, if it, at high energies, you're not actually sensitive to the full energy of the proton. You're sensitive to some very small fraction x of its energy. So the point to take away from that is that when you have a 7 TeV LHC, most of the interactions shouldn't be thought of, or should be thought of as quark QQ bar or QQ or Q glue or glue glue interactions. It's what you're producing, but at energies that are typically much less than 7 TeV. And turns out that actually has some very positive, useful consequences, which I will talk about next time. So again, the thing to take away from this is that there is a universal function that describes the structure of a proton. One can measure it in EP scattering, and I'll talk about the applications to proton-proton scattering at the beginning of next lecture, and then go through some examples of how one actually produces the heavy particles of a standard model. So the W, the Z, and the top quark were all discovered at hadron colliders, and we can see. We'll talk about their rates, how to understand the production rates, and what they actually look like next time. Any questions? means that, you know, if you want to produce something that's that close to the boundary, probably you're a lot